Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. It's great to be back. It's been 2 weeks. We had the weather issues, electric issues, and whatever issue the week before. So if I stammer, I haven't talked in 2 weeks. Anyway, good morning. We're going to talk about estate planning. What is the experience like? And who better to lead that than Mark Levine, partner, handler, and Levine with offices in Bethesda and Virginia. Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Bob. How are you?
Great. And John Elliott, federal benefits strategist, retired Fed, retired seminar presenter, but still does the emails and still comes on the show. Good morning, John.
Morning, Bob and Mark.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen you as well. Okay, Mark, what should the experience be like? Is it really an experience?
It should be like a ride at Disney World, I think. A lot of people, I think one of the big reasons people don't do estate planning is they don't know what to expect. They don't know what the process is going to be like. They dread having the conversations, not just with the attorney, but with each other if you're married, or I guess with yourself if you're single, about the decisions that have to be made. And I think the process itself can be very intimidating to people, intimidating enough that they just don't do it. They put it off. They don't think about it, et cetera. And so, yeah.
Could I just say one thing before we get too much further? Because some people may be listening and say, I'll never have an estate issue. An estate doesn't mean that you have $5 million. It doesn't mean that you have $3.5 million. It means you got something. Okay.
Right.
I'm sorry to say that, but I didn't want people to fade off before you got into really what you're here for.
Sure, because estate planning is not about just the amount of money you have or even just what happens to it. The estate planning process deals with lifetime documents, powers of attorney, health care directives, which everybody needs. Doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, married or single, have kids or don't. Everybody needs the lifetime documents, wills, trusts, beneficiary designations, things like that. So estate planning is not about necessarily or entirely where does all your money go. It's about the entire process of making sure all of these things work together, point in the same direction, are consistent with each other. And that's an important part of the process. And I think there are some of those things that people miss. And I think part of why understanding how the experience and the process works is important. But absolutely, it's not just about how much money you have. From the time you turn 18 to the time you die, everybody needs to do estate planning, whether it's just the lifetime documents or it's the entire package of things that people do. Everybody needs to do some of it. There's no question about that.
When you do the seminars and or when somebody comes into your office that is who we're trying to reach today, that I don't need an estate discussion. And they might come up to you at the break, might come up to you after class and ask you that question. And your response then, as well as when they finally come in the front door and they go, well, you know, why am I here?
Right. I think it actually starts before that. In other words, often what will happen is I'll get an email from someone who said, I saw you at a seminar. And I'd like to find out if I need an estate plan. I'd like to find out what the process is, how does this work a little bit. And one of the things that we send them back, and I send back an email explaining some of these things, but one of the things we send them, and most good attorneys are going to send, is a questionnaire. And the questionnaires are set up as many different ways as there are attorneys. Ours is set up so that there are sort of three areas that we want clients to be thinking about before they come in. And I think this helps people understand what we're going to be covering. There's biographical information, there's financial information, and there is issues. Who do I want to be in charge of these different facets of things while I'm alive, at my death, for my health care? And I think that when people sort of look over that, they realize the scope of really what they're dealing with. And so for some people, the who gets my money, and in their minds, what little money I have, is sometimes very easy for people. Oh, you know, I have two adult kids, they're great, everything's wonderful, they get it all out right. Whereas the who's in charge of me if I become incompetent or who's in charge of my health care could be very complicated for them. Or they have pets and there are complicated issues when it comes to their pets. So the scope of what you deal with as part of estate planning is pretty wide. And typically when people think of it, and it is the typical situation, you're dealing with money. You're dealing with who gets it and how they get it and how it's structured. And if you're a federal government employee, you have more than you think. Because what most people think about as their estate is, what could I use to go buy a car? And most of us look at what we have to go buy a car and say, well, I don't have very much, do I? But that's not what your estate is. Your estate is the equity in your house and the amount of your TSP. And if you have Fegley, what the insurance benefit is and all of those things that you can't get to right now to do anything with, but are going to go to your heirs when you die. So most federal employees have more of an estate than they think they have. And most people in general have more to deal with than they think they do.
A lot of federal employees, and I would guess it's the younger federal employees, say, well, I filled out a beneficiary form for my TSP account. I filled it out for my life insurance. What do I need a will for?
Right. And again, that's – again, in the seminars, we deal with that in depth. I mean, we talk very specifically about the fact that beneficiary designations are one-way assets travel. Wills are another. Joint assets are another. Trusts are another. And the job of the estate planner is to make sure that all of those different ways of transferring assets at death are pointed in the same direction, that you don't end up with your will saying go to X, but your beneficiary designation saying go to Y.
Okay. The other thing that a federal employee has, if they have a survivor's annuity, it's called the present value of the annuity. The annuity that we're talking about here is not anything to do with the thrift. It's years in service and highest compensation. Now, of course, if that's going to a spouse, it's kind of in and out, but it does go into the gross estate and comes back out as a subtraction. But if unfortunately there was a minor child or something, there could be an issue there, and I'm getting probably too deep too quick. But it goes back to your comment.
I mean, yes. I mean, there's a substantive issue of there's a death benefit that comes out, even if it's an adult child. In other words, if you're vested, you've paid in a certain amount of money over the years into FERS or CSRS, and that money is going to come out even if it's not going to a spouse. But that's a limited amount of money, and if you've retired, it's gone very quickly, and that is just another asset that we want to make sure we direct in the right place.
Nope. Yeah, if you're – particularly if you're a CSRS and you die, say, before and you have substantial years of service, you could have six figures easily in that retirement fund that needs to go to somebody.
Right. It doesn't come out as the annuity, but it's going to go out as a lump sum to your
beneficiary. If there's no spouse, well, she automatically gets an annuity. But say that you're not married and you don't have minor children, then somebody has to get that money. And particularly in the service people's case, it could be a lot of money that has to go to somebody.
Okay, so I'm listening to the show here, or I'm listening to you in the seminar. I'm going, never thought I needed to really check this out. What then prompts somebody to give you a call other than, yeah, I heard it, and but when they go home, they forget it. But it's going to register with some people. And how do you get them to cross the threshold? We're not talking about sales. We're talking about providing a service. What do you find the trigger point is with people that would otherwise not come to get them to come?
Right. Well, I think, you know, stepping back from that a moment, when we're talking to people in the seminars, you know, obviously this is what I do for a living. I'm happy when people call me, but there are lots of reasons people aren't interested in calling me, whether it's geography, whether they just didn't like me, whether they didn't think I was very
impossible.
Smart. I know, but I assume it happens. And so what we like to start with is assuming that you don't have someone identified you want to go to, where do you find someone? How do you find a lawyer to sit down and trust with your information and trust their process and what they're going to do and that the things that they're going to do are appropriate for what you need. And we start sort of with the don'ts, which is don't trust the Yellow Pages. For years, we had a Yellow Pages ad, and the ad rep only ever asked me, do I like the ad and have I signed the contract? Because she did not care what I do. She doesn't care if I'm good at what I do. She doesn't care if I'm ethical about what I do. I mean, she may care, but it's not going to affect her willingness to sell me an ad in the Yellow Pages. What they care about is getting it on the page. And so Yellow Pages ads are advertisements. They tell you what the attorney wants to be doing, not necessarily what they're good at doing. Any attorney is assumed ethically, quote unquote, to be competent to practice law in any of these areas. And so it is not unethical to say, put an ad in that says, I do wills. Because you're presumed to be able to do wills. What we can't do, at least in this area, you can in some parts of the country, is we can't say we specialize. So in fact, I cannot, even though I do in a way, say I specialize in estate planning. I could say I concentrate, I can say I practice in, but I can't say I specialize in it. No attorney, certainly in this area, and I'll talk about the exceptions throughout the country, can say they specialize in an area unless I think it's patent law where there's a separate patent bar. Some states do allow a separate certification, a separate exam or certification process where you can say certified, bar certified in estate planning. I think California has that, and I think some other states where they can actually say that. So I could run an ad that says, call me for your DWIs. I shouldn't, because I know nothing about DWIs, have no interest in doing them, and would probably be very, very bad at doing them. But I could. And so that's the problem with the Yellow Pages. The Yellow Pages tells you what the lawyer wants to be doing, does not tell you what they're good at doing, what their history is in doing that. So it's really important to understand what you're looking at when you look through those pages or books or advertisements. That's all they are, is advertisements. You want to be careful about personal referrals to some extent as well, in the sense that you want to make sure that the person you're talking to, they're giving you someone who has done this for them. So you don't want to use your brother-in-law's DWI attorney to do your will. I don't know why most people seem to have a brother-in-law who has a DWI attorney, but that's not the guy you want to do the work. You do not want someone who is what we would call a slash attorney. Their advertising says DWI, immigration, domestic, wills and trusts, et cetera. You want to go to someone who does the thing you're going to them for as the primary part of their practice. Most DWI attorneys do criminal work, so that all fits within the same sort of ambit. But a DWI attorney who specializes, and again, can't use that word, but practices in DWI and estate planning is rare. Someone who actually spends the time doing both. And so you want someone who spends their time doing the thing that you're going to them for as the primary part of their practice. So you want to ask those questions of people who are giving you referrals. This guy may be the best criminal attorney in the world, may be terrible at doing estate planning, and would be a horrible choice for you to go see them to do that work.
Do many attorneys know? I mean, for example, you say DWI. In my world, I don't like to do financial statement audits. All right. Can I do them? Yep. Do I do them on a normal basis? Nope. So in your case, how can you extract that information from the person when you talk to them?
You talk to them about what they do, about what their practice. Chances are they're going to give themselves away in the sense that their advertising, their website, the things that they say about their practice, they're going to tell you the other things that they do. In one of those venues. Also, again, if it's a personal referral, if he did a criminal case for your brother-in-law, you know, why is he doing an estate planning case for you? And maybe he did the criminal case 15 years ago, and 14 years ago he moved his practice entirely to estate planning. Well, great, that makes sense. But if not, those are the types of things that are going to sort of give someone away, that they're doing a number of different things. And typically, younger lawyers tend to do everything because they're afraid they'll never get a client again. And as lawyers get older and more experienced in terms of what they're doing, they're going to focus in on the things that they're doing more specifically.
Okay. Now, once again, by the way, I should say I don't do financial statement audits, but people in the firm do. I really messed up with that. But I'm a tax accountant, and my partner, he's an accountant's accountant. Just anyway. So let's get back now to the person coming in the door. Once you get them in the door, how do you calm them down? Because they're probably, I won't say all, kind of off the wall, they're maybe a little intimidated. You know, I'm talking to an attorney about things I don't talk to anybody about.
Well, I think a good attorney is going to, again, start this before they walk in the door with the questionnaire. Because hopefully the questionnaire is done in such a way so that they have an idea of what they're coming in to talk about. They have seen these questions that I'm going to ask them when we're sitting down across from each other about what do you want to happen if, and what's going to happen in this situation, and who are the people that are involved in your estate plan, so that now when they walk in the door, it's not as much of a mystery as it may have been before they ever thought about it or et cetera. So hopefully I've done some of that work and the attorney's done some of that work before they walk in where they've thought about some of those things. I think that the meeting itself can be intimidating because you don't still know exactly what you're going to talk about. I think My own way of dealing with clients is sometimes clients have a pressing issue. They have a reason they're coming in. It's a death in the family. It's an illness. It's a child that has a problem. And so I like to get those things out of the way, because no matter what other questions I ask them, if they have a pressing issue, that's going to be what they want to talk about. But I think that most attorneys, other than dealing with that issue, are going to have a way of a process of walking through it. But just turning back one second to we talked about how to find an attorney and how not to find someone. It's hard to find someone that you can trust. I would talk to your friends and your colleagues, your family members who have done estate planning, and talk to them about their experience with their attorney. And I think getting that story from them is going to help you feel comfortable with that person you're going in to see if you're going to take that. And I would talk to your financial advisor, and I would talk to your accountant to get referrals. If you don't have another resource, those are people who deal with estate planning attorneys every day. And their clients deal with them every day. And they will hear the complaints from their clients when they don't like the estate planning attorney. And they will hear the accolades from their clients when they do like the estate planning attorney. And they'll have their own experience of, when I call this guy, do I get a call back? When I call this guy, does he have any idea what he's talking about? And so I think that if you have an accountant or you have a financial advisor, those are really good resources to use to find an estate planning attorney, because they are people who deal with these people professionally and they deal with their clients. And so they know. I know when there are bad accountants or financial planners, the clients tell me, you know, this guy, I don't like him. He doesn't answer my calls. He doesn't do this. He doesn't do that. So I'm sure that that's what they're saying to their other professionals about their estate planning attorney. So I think that when you're looking to get that name, that's where you would go.
Okay, we got your name, but we don't have your contact points. So how does one get in contact with you, Mark?
That's an excellent segue, Bob. You get in contact with me. My phone number is 301-961-6464, and it's extension 3313. Again, it's 301-961-6464. And my email address is Mark, M-A-R-C, at HandlerLevine.com, HandlerLevine.com. And the website is HandlerLevine.com. So it's Mark, M-A-R-C, at HandlerLevine.com, or you can get in touch with us through the website as well.
Great. All righty. So now we have the ability to contact you. And how do we then become next more comfortable to coming into you or whomever?
Well, I think, again, if you've done your homework, you read the website, you look at the questionnaires, you may talk to a couple of people in terms of when you're making an appointment. I think that the process itself, then, the meetings can only go on so long. What I find is after about an hour and a half at most, the meetings lose their usefulness. And so you want to make sure that you're still getting something out of it. You're not glazing over. And so hopefully the attorney is sort of guiding you through that meeting, getting the information they need, asking the questions, explaining things to you as much as possible. But the fact is that in this meeting, it's the first time you're hearing a lot of this stuff. It's the first time you're being explained the estate tax situation as it stands today, and why it is that, you know, giving everything outright to your son doesn't work if ultimately you never want it going to your daughter-in-law. And so what are the other options? And we're going to walk through these things and talk about things, and you 98% of the time are going to say, well, that sounds like a great idea. Yeah, let's do that. And at the end of that meeting, you're going to be so done talking about who dies when, and what if you die, and what if your spouse dies, and what if your kids die, and what if you're incompetent, and what if you're, all of these different horrible situations. And so you're glad for the meeting to end normally, and you agree with the attorney on what you're going to do. And you talk about what the setup will be and what the thing's going to look like, and you leave the office, and you're glad to be done with it. But that's not the end of the process. The process isn't meet with an attorney, get drafts, come back in and sign everything. The process includes changes, asking questions, understanding what it is that you're doing, and what your estate plan is going to look like. So it's important when you talk to the attorney about what happens next that it's clear that there is more that's going to happen, that you're going to have questions, because inevitably you're going to get documents in the mail or by email, and you're going to have questions. You're going to procrastinate. You're not going to look at them as quickly as you might, or as quickly as you told the attorney that you would. 75% of my clients, when they get that email, they click unread and forget about it if they can. And it's not until I send them a nice, gentle reminder letter a month later that says, hey, did you get a chance to look at that stuff, that they pull it out. So it's been 2 months since you met with the attorney. And you sit down and look at these things and you have questions. I know we talked about this, but I don't quite understand how that works with that. Why can't he speak in English? Why does it take 6 pages to do this? I know we said my brother, but I think maybe my sister would be better. I know we said age 40 for the kids, but, thinking about it, I think maybe it should be 35. And you're going to come back and you're going to give that information to the attorney. Now, usually it's going to be by email or by phone, occasionally by meeting, but normally it can be handled by phone or email. But the important thing is that is part of the process. It shouldn't be extra. You shouldn't be afraid to express that. And you also want to make sure that, when you are talking to the attorney and figuring out how you're going to pay for this, that it's included in the process. And so one of the really important things to do at the end of the meeting is talk about the fee and what it's going to cost and how that's going to be structured.
One question that I asked the last time we were on this show together, but I think it bears it's useful information to have for our listeners, is if you've got your will, and let's say your spouse dies later on, many years later, if you decide to remarry, and I asked, should you get a prenup? You said yes. Which is good information to have. You want to explain why you would need a prenup or want a prenup?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a lot of really important substantive issues that go into why a prenup's important. And it goes into the fact that, married people like to own things jointly, or if it's separate, the surviving spouse has rights in regard to the estate of the deceased spouse. So oftentimes what happens is mom dies, dad, because they didn't do estate planning, ends up with everything, dad gets remarried, dad dies, and everything goes to stepmother.
And you might want it to go to your children.
You might want it to go to your children instead.
And not a dime to go to your wife or husband, new wife or husband, because they may have their own resources.
Right. Typically, it's some sort of mix. I mean, there's a more and less wealthy spouse sometimes, and sometimes it's very important for the surviving spouse to make sure that their new spouse is taken care of. And so how do we do that as well? How do you take care of the surviving spouse while still making sure what's left goes to the kids? I think how that relates to the estate planning process is that I will often get phone calls from people saying, I don't want to come in with my spouse yet. I am getting remarried, or I am remarried, and we have different issues, and I'd like to come in first and talk to you. And I think that happens a lot, because it's important to understand that the relationship between the husband and the wife and the estate planning attorney, the privilege exists between the three of them, but not to any two of them specifically. So if I meet with a husband and wife and the wife calls me and says, listen, I don't want you to tell my husband this, but I have this other person I want to leave money to and I want you to change my will, but don't tell him. I can't do that. The privilege exists with everybody. And so once the husband and wife have come in, the two husbands or the two wives have come in to have this conversation with me, they're both my client. And so I will sometimes get people coming in saying, listen, I may want my wife to come in and do this estate planning with me at some point in the future, but right now I just want to come in and talk to you, so that the relationship is just between you and the attorney. And I have a number of clients where I represent the wife, but I don't represent the husband, for example. They have their own estate planning attorney. They have their own estate planning issues. And we will sometimes work together where that's necessary, because they do have common issues and common goals and things that they want to deal with. But you do want to think about that when you're calling the attorney. If you're in that situation, maybe you just want to come in yourself and you don't want to come in as a couple yet.
So sometimes you could, in fact, be like a mediator. I'd imagine there is a percent, correct me if I'm wrong, of people that won't come in only because the two, not everybody's a couple, can't agree on who's going to get what or who's going to control what, forget the size of the estate, or an individual that either has the significant other or doesn't and is conflicted by, who's going to take care of me and who's going to get what. Do you ever get kind of like you're the not the mediator, but you try to talk to both to come to the best resolution?
I think that what I tell clients is a lot of the procrastination occurs because they don't know what the process feels like. A lot of it occurs because there's a central issue they don't agree on. And very often that's guardianship. I don't want our kids with your brother. Well, I don't want our kids with your sister. Very often it's not the guardianship, but who's in charge of the money. Occasionally it's who gets the money, but more often than not, it's dealing with the kids, dealing with their money or their guardianship. And what I tell clients anytime, especially where you're sort of down to one big issue, is come in and let's deal with all the other issues. And then let's focus on that one, because when you really only have one issue to deal with, generally we can deal with it. I've been doing this for 20 years. It's unlikely that your situation is entirely unique, that I've never dealt with clients who have had something similar before. And talking to the attorney about, what are the duties of the trustee versus the guardian? Can you have joint trustees? And how does that actually work if you do that? Can you have joint guardianship with people who aren't sort of husband and wife, and how would that actually work? And a lot of times their preconceptions I can answer and correct, and more often than not, that leads them to the end result of agreeing on somebody. Once they get more and more information and they can place that against the people that they think would be right, and they go, oh, well, you know what? My person really isn't right for this. Let's go with that person. And then ultimately, if they can't, I come back to my mantra with clients, which is, don't let perfect get in the way of better. Right now, you all have nothing. You have chaos if something happens to you. Neither of you may think this is the perfect answer, but it's better than nothing. Let's not let perfect get in the way of better. Let's get something done, and then we can obsess over this one detail and whether it's correct for the next year if you want, but you have something in place.
Now, for those of you all sitting on the fence listening to the show, today is July 9th. It's about 10:33. We're on for about another 20 minutes, 25 minutes, but you can get the perfect call to the perfect person to provide you the initial perfect answer if you'd like to call us, and you should. It's 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. Remember again, this is July 9th because this show gets repeated fairly often. It's 10:33 a.m. and we're on till about 10:58. If you're listening to it, other than that, please don't call, but you can email us. We'll do the email in a while. Anyway, sorry, Mark.
No, not at all.
It seemed like a good segue there.
So, we're sort of at the end of the meeting, and you have to talk about money. And a lot of clients are very upfront. It's the first thing they want to talk about. So in the email and the phone call, they'll say, well, what's it going to cost? And other clients are very reticent. They don't want to talk about money. They're nervous to talk about money. They're afraid to have that conversation. But it's absolutely vital you do. Most of the time when I have clients coming into me who worked with another attorney and they were unhappy with them, more often than not, it's not even the price that it cost them that offended them. It was the lack of communication. It's when the client comes in and says, well, I went back to this attorney who had done my work 15 years ago, and he said we needed to make this change and that change and that change, and then I got a bill for this amount, this many thousands of dollars or that. And as I'll say to them, that amount isn't out of line. That's not a ridiculous amount of money to charge you for this. But the real issue for them is they had no idea. They left the meeting assuming that what they paid 15 years ago is what they were going to pay today. And that's just not the case. But there was no communication. And it's really important to have that conversation with your attorney. What's it going to cost to do the work? And what's included? What's the package? What am I getting for this? And I think there are two ways that attorneys get paid. There's an hourly fee. For every hour the attorney works, he or she charges you X amount per hour. And then there's a flat fee. And most estate planning work is done on a flat fee basis. Not all. We have clients that we work with on an hourly basis because that's more appropriate in their situation, or they prefer it. Some do. But a lot of the work is done on a flat fee basis. And usually by the end of the meeting, that initial meeting, the attorney should be able to say to you, this is what we're going to charge you. This is what we're going to do. This is what it's going to cost. Here's how you're going to pay it. So some attorneys are going to require half up front and half when you sign. Some are going to be, we do half when we send you the drafts and half when everything's ready to be signed. And I think that there's no right or wrong there. It's the deal that you cut with the attorney, and that's fine. What's important is to talk about what's included in that flat fee, because that flat fee should include the process. And as we talked about, the process is before, you're going to get a questionnaire, you're going to think about things. The process is the meeting, and the process is after the meeting as well. It's not just meet, get the documents, come in and sign the documents. You have questions. There are things you're never going to understand about your estate planning, and most people don't need to. The rule against perpetuities takes most law students a good half a semester to understand, much less then to explain. And unless it applies in your particular situation, you probably don't need to know it. So, you know, the attorney probably is going to decline to spend an hour talking to you about the rule against perpetuities. But you should understand how someone becomes a trustee of your kids. And if something happens to them, how does the successor trustee take over? And when do they use the money for their kids? And what can they do and what can't they do? Can they invest in their son's startup company in their garage? Or are there more standards that apply to what they can do? And so there are questions you're going to ask, you want to get answered, and need to understand. And there are other things that the attorney's going to say to you, look, it's really not going to probably apply in your situation. We put things in to deal with the worst case scenarios, the unlikely scenarios, but it's not really probably an issue you have to be concerned about. There are other questions or changes that are part of the process. I know I said my brother was going to be the trustee, but nope, we want to change that to my sister. Well, the attorney shouldn't charge you to make that change. That's part of the process of doing the estate planning if you're doing a flat fee. On the other hand, I have clients who say, I know I said we didn't need a trust for my son, but in the last 3 months, he's turned out to be a much bigger knucklehead than we ever thought he was going to be. And in fact, we want to add a trust for my son to our estate plan. Well, now you're adding a piece of work. We're adding issues. And probably the attorney's going to charge you something additional in order to do that work. So the honing down of things, the ages, the who the worst case scenario family disaster beneficiaries are, the who the charity is and things like that, those are all things that are probably going to come after. You're going to put into the documents and you may change the documents to some extent, but that isn't a change to the flat fee you've negotiated with the attorney normally. So you want to make sure that when you leave that office, you understand what the cost is going to be and what you're going to be getting for that.
Okay, so I've been listening to this, and I'm going to call Mark, and I really like what he says, but I know that I can put this on paper, so I'm going to have my will prepared by myself via a computer program, and I bring it in. I said, Mark, you know, let's have the meeting, but here, make adjustments to this. Will you?
No.
I didn't think so.
So I've had a number of clients who've sat down with any number of different programs and answered questions and put in their information. And I won't say that it's not at all helpful to me. It's great for the spellings of names. It's great for, to some extent, showing the thought you've had about who you want to be in charge of things. But I don't know how they put their documents together. I don't know how they define terms. I don't know how or what state they've necessarily based it on, or if they've done it correctly. So I've spent a lot of time on my documents. I've spent a lot of time correcting them, researching them, making sure that they make sense and knowing what they mean. And so it's going to take me more time, and it's going to be a lot more aggravating to me to read through that and try and quote unquote correct it than for me to use things that I know and have confidence in already. And quite frankly, I don't have a lot of interest in doing it. I'm not, I don't enjoy it. And it's not, to me, the creative process of sitting down with an attorney, with a client, and talking about what it is that we're doing for you and your family. The problem with programs is they don't ask you enough or the correct questions. They don't ask you how your kids get along. They don't ask you what you feel about your daughter-in-law or son-in-law or father-in-law or mother-in-law or brother-in-law. They don't ask you, specifics about the importance of a particular piece of property versus another piece of property. They're going to treat all of that the same, and they're going to assume that if you think two people should serve as trustee, they must get along great. And they're never going to go behind those questions. And they don't challenge your preconceptions. I have a lot of clients who come in and say, well, I can't have a trust because my kids have already turned 18. So you can't have a trust for them. Well, that's not true. You can have a trust for your kids for as long as you want to have a trust for your kids. The computer program is never going to say to you, well, that's not true. You don't have to do that if you don't want to. So I think that the programs are usually, I guess, worth what you pay for them. I've had clients call me and say, look, I'm leaving tomorrow for some place not so safe, and should I do this or should I do nothing? Well, you should do that. That's better than nothing, but just.
Very, very good. Now, when the documents, this is a process, like you say, so let's take the first cut or the final cut. Do people read the documents closely and come back and say, you know, I don't understand paragraph 36 and how it applies to paragraph 18? Or do they just kind of sign them because you've educated them so well? I'm not trying to stroke you with this. I mean, this would be the case regardless.
And the answer is a good lawyer's answer, which is yes and no. I have clients who have read every word of every document I've ever prepared for them and have had comments and have made corrections and have found grammatical errors or, you know, the prepositions in the wrong place and have corrected them. And so, you know, we have clients who do that, and we have clients who say, I understand the structure, I trust you, I'm going to go with that. And so they run the gamut. Now, I've had clients who I think have abused the process. In other words, we have a flat fee for clients, and the clients want to spend 20 hours over the next 3 months talking about every page of the document. And I have clients who have taken years to do it. I mean, they're so specific, it becomes procrastination. And over a certain amount of time, you're going to find that the flat fee may change. You know, my worst case was a client who started the process in the fall of 1999 and completed the process in the spring of 2011. What I quoted them for a price in 1999 is not ultimately what I charged them in 2011 for the work. Documents change, the laws change. If you take too long, you're going to end up in a situation where we've got to go back and revise the documents because the power of attorney law changed from the time we sent it to you to the time that we're now planning to sign it or getting to that process. But at the end of the day, it's important to let the attorney know what you feel is important for you to do. And I've had clients come in and say, look, I need the time. I need the answers. I need this conversation or I won't be comfortable, and let the attorney price that accordingly.
All right. I recently had clients call up and they understand the estate tax law in 2012 might not be the same as 2013. Now, again, we're talking about an awful lot of money. And so I said, no, whether we're talking about an amount over that or above that, I said, that's really not the heart of what you want to do. It might be the healthcare powers of attorney, the directives, who's going to be the beneficiaries and whatnot. That's not going to change. The dollar magnitude may change, but may not impact you. Gift issues, filing gift tax returns, and that sounds, again, horribly exotic, but I had somebody just the other day, they have a child in need, and they needed to get them $20,000. Well, they were not married, so it would involve a gift tax return, which wouldn't cost any gift tax.
Right.
But I can't do the gift. So give them the money to this year, some give some next year. No, they need it right now. Do a note, tear the note up next year, and collect some interest. I'm probably going to get in trouble with you for telling people that. But nonetheless, I've noticed now, we don't know what's going to go on, so we don't want to do this. And it's, well, that's the icing on the cake, if you will. You got to bake the cake first.
Right. And a good estate planning attorney is going to talk to you about the possibility of changes in the estate tax law, and they're going to explain how the documents act if they do and how the documents act if they don't. And I have very pessimistic clients who are positive that Congress will do nothing and it'll be a million-dollar exemption. And I have more realistic clients who say, well, probably sooner or later they're going to do something and we're going to assume that it's going to be this larger exemption. And to some extent, it's the client's own willingness to bet on one or the other, or if they want to bet on neither, then making sure the documents work as best they can in both scenarios. And that's the estate planner's job. I mean, that's our job, is to make sure that the documents work as well as they can, whether the estate tax exemption is $1 million or $5 million. Obviously, the amount of tax you pay is going to be radically different, but we still want to make sure they work as well as they can and protect as much as they can in either scenario. Personally, I think ultimately we're going to have a very similar estate tax structure. I think ultimately it'll be a $5 million plus exemption, et cetera. But I don't control Congress. That's certainly true.
Yeah, and that's a lot. And probably many of our listening audience are not going to be in that situation. But that doesn't mean they don't need to see an estate planner.
Taxes are not the main reason people come to me. Far and away. I mean, anyone with minor children, taxes are secondary at best. It is control. It is making sure that it's held for your kids in such a way that they're going to be productive citizens. For a lot of other people, taxes, minimizing taxes is very important. But that's not the reason they came in. They came in because they want to make sure that if something happens to them, their husband's taken care of, or that their child is taken care of, that their pets are taken care of, or that they're taken care of if they're incompetent. So the desire to make sure that the people you love are taken care of, and whether that means controlling money for them or giving money to them or whatever you're doing with it, I think that's the primary mover for most people.
How often should you revisit your will?
So we suggest to clients that they come in for a checkup every 3 years or so. We send out a letter to clients every 3 years or so, 3 or 4 years, depending on what's going on with the estate tax. Clients universally ignore that letter. They almost never come in after 3 years unless something has occurred in their lives. But usually we send another letter out a couple years later. In that 5-year period, people will come in. And I think that's sort of a minimum. Obviously, as your life changes, that's going to dictate it. So births, deaths, inheritance, divorce, marriage. If you win the lottery, we don't have to be the first call, but we should be in the top 5 or so of people you call to deal with that change in circumstances.
Okay, I would be a little neglect. Before I came in, we did have one email, and I kind of brought this up before we went on air. What is the difference, or what is a residual trust and a non-residual trust, or estate?
So I'm guessing what the emailer was asking about was a residuary bequest versus a non-residuary bequest. In your will or in your trust, you leave things either specifically or generally. I leave Bob $10,000. I leave John my Swiss Army knife. Those are specific bequests. And then I say I leave everything else to my kids. That is a residuary bequest. The residuary bequest gets made after all the taxes are paid, after the attorney's paid, the accountant, all the specific bequests are done. What's left is the residuary.
Kind of like residual?
Residual, exactly. And that may go to one person, to 10 people, to 50 people, but that's the residual. We don't know how much it's going to be ahead of time. Whereas I know you're getting that $10,000 because I said, give Bob $10,000. And I know John's getting that Swiss Army knife because I said, give John that Swiss Army knife. So it's specific. We know what they're getting. Residual, we'll see what's left, and you get all of it, you get half of it, you get 10% of it, whatever the testamentary document may say.
Can I buy John's knife for $10,000 because I know it was an antique?
That's absolutely.
You got it. You got it.
John thought I was jipping.
I already have a Swiss Army knife.
But mine's better, though. So.
Okay. But for $10,000, you've got it.
All right.
So, you know, going back to the process, one of the things I want to make sure that clients – people understand is what they should be leaving with. What is the estate planner doing for whatever money you're paying him or her? Every estate plan needs to include a last will and testament. That's a bedrock, whether you're doing trusts, whether you think you have nothing, etc. A last will and testament is important because it assigns a person to be in charge of things like your last tax return, dealing with your debts, things like that. If you have pets, if you have minor children, it deals with those issues at a minimum. Everybody needs a will. A power of attorney for financial and legal matters. Everybody needs one. From the day you turn 18 to the day you die, everyone should have a financial legal power of attorney. Advanced medical directive. Naming the person who's going to make healthcare decisions for you if you can't make them for yourself and what those decisions would be. Everybody needs that. The other thing that everybody needs in every situation almost is a review and usually revisions to your beneficiary designations. I think that if there's a general mistake or something missing in the estate plans that I see sometimes is that while there's a perfectly great will or trust, the beneficiary designations have not been done in a way to work with that will. So we talked about how beneficiary designations can leave things differently than the will perhaps. My will says leave everything in trust for my kids, but my beneficiary designation says just leave it to my kids. Well, the trust doesn't control that. If I want the trust to control my life insurance, I've got to make sure the beneficiary designation for my life insurance says leave it to my trust in my will for my kids. I've got to tie the two together. And so beneficiary designations are estate planning documents. They are every bit as important for most people as your will. You have to make sure that they are done as part of the estate planning process. So most estate planning attorneys are going to help you make sure they're filled out correctly. They're going to make sure they're signed correctly and make sure that's done as part of the process. A lot of people use revocable trusts as part of their estate planning. So obviously, if you're doing that, that would be part of the flat fee you would be doing. And then deeds. How's the property going to be transferred into the trust? Talk to the attorney about that as well.
Okay, so there's a lot going on to get into the, excuse me, there might not be as much going on getting into the door, but once in the door, then your job is to make sure that the orchestra plays in tune with the conductor's desires.
That's good. I think of myself more as a traffic cop than a symphony conductor, but I like the symphony conductor better.
Or you could be the lead guitar for wherever. Anyway. So we just we got about six more minutes. How often we talked about how often to revisit, make sure you get the documents right. Some people are going to read it more closely than others, and some people too closely. And I have clients like that, and they just pore over the tax returns, and that's their right. I mean, that's
absolutely
what they came for, and I better have the right answers. And then you have people that are referred. To me, it was a funny story. It was many years ago. This individual came in, very smart, and deadpan humor, and said, "I'm here upon two recommendations. One was from a Democrat and one was from a Republican. I guess you can't be all bad."
There you go.
So I don't know if you've ever had anybody, but I'll just never forget that. It's probably 20 years ago.
You do. I mean, it's always nice when clients refer you. It makes me feel good that I provided something to them that they feel like they're willing to put their name on what I'll do. And so that's always very nice. I always take that very seriously, whether it's from a client or an accountant or a financial planner. I think that's a nice thing that someone's been willing to do that for you. I think one of the other things that people ask a lot about is what happens after I die? Who is going to be there to help my kids or my spouse? Are you going to be there? That's a question a lot of people ask of me. You know, my youngest kid is six. I'm not going anywhere. And I got 12 more years of before someone's out of the house and 16 more years before I'm done with college. So I'm not going anywhere. But it's a good question to ask the attorney is what happens when someone dies? Do I come to you? A lot of clients ask the question, is it included in what I paid? You know, is that part of the service, is that you do the estate for my kids? And the answer to that is no. I mean, that's going to be a separate fee, a separate process. One of the things that people can do to make it easier for your kids or your spouse is collect information ahead of time. I suggest making a notebook. And in that notebook, put the first page of every account you have, whether it's a credit card account, a bank account, a brokerage account, whatever it may be. And just that front page is going to give your spouse or your kids or the estate attorney so much information. Where your accounts are, what the account numbers are, what the phone number is to call them and tell them that you've passed away and start the process. So that helps tremendously if something happens to somebody. And I think that's something that concerns a lot of clients, that they're making this relationship with the estate planning attorney, both in terms with an eye towards their relationship with them, but also their kids' relationship with them. And I have clients who come in and will call me and say, look, my kids are in town. Can we just come in? I'd like them to meet you. I'd like them to know your face. I'd like them to talk to you so that if something happens 5 years from now, it's not the first time that they've ever met you or talked to you or know where your office is or things like that.
In your experience, people as they age become more concerned about this than they do when they're maybe younger. But you might be talking to a parent of somebody younger. Do you ever say, listen, Sam or Sally, maybe you ought to consider this? And let's say they're out of high school or maybe they're into their fifth year of work. They probably should think about it. No?
Absolutely. You know, as I said, the power of attorney and the healthcare directive are from the day you turn 18. Those apply. the will, what happens to the stuff. A lot of clients, a lot of people say, well, literally, I'm 19 years old. I don't have anything. That may be possible, but it doesn't take long before it starts becoming an issue. I think the three times people come in, you know, you have a kid, that triggers, you know, most people to start thinking about this. You're looking at retiring, which is later than you should be dealing with it, but when a lot of people do. And then as they get significantly older, you know, I have people coming to me in their 80s who've never done an estate plan. And, you know, it's only now that they've gotten to the point where, statistically speaking, they actually feel like they could die that they're coming in and dealing with it.
All righty. How about when somebody first gets married or lives with a significant other?
I think it depends on the situation. I think a lot of times in those situations, if you've been married a month and something happens to one of you, you're happy for the assets to go back to your family. There are no kids. There's no nothing they're depending on for you. On the other hand, you know, significant others can be around or, you know, for years and depend on you. And I think a lot of it is about your goal. Does this person depend on you? And if so, if something happens to you, what do you want to happen? You may not have an obligation, but you that may be what you want, is to make sure to take care of them.
Okay, this has been a great succession of getting in the door. I don't want to compare you to the, let's say, doctor, not dentist. But, you know, it's going to be painful, and I don't know what to expect. And I think you really walked it through, and we didn't talk about the stuff that people's eyes glaze over. And this would be good. You might even reference it sometimes in your seminars if you run short of time.
That's good.
Because this will be archived.
Yep.
John, we got less than a minute.
Well, I went through the process recently, and I was anything but painful, I have to say. And I guess full disclosure, which Mark wouldn't mind having disclosed, I use Mark because I've been on the radio with him a number of times and said, well, he sounds like he knows what he's talking about, so I'll go to Mark.
You can't get better than that, Mark. Anyway, we got to wrap it up. Next week, we're going to have Karen Schaefer on with John Elliott, and Karen's a certified financial planner, and she's always a delight.
And owns a bar, too.
Yeah, well, that's Daddy Rick's. That's in the house. Anyway, so please tune in next week. Please pass the word on. This show will be archived about 2 o'clock this afternoon. Thank you, Andrew, and talk to you all next week.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.